Pleased to introduce you today to Dr. Paul Blanc, a professor of medicine, holds the endowed chair in occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California in San Francisco, and he's the author of How Everyday Products Make People Sick, Toxins at Home and in the Workplace. It's published by the University of California Press, and in his book, he talks about hidden health dangers in many seemingly innocent products we encounter every day. Tube of glue in the kitchen drawer, maybe a bottle of bleach in the laundry room, a rayon scarf on a closet shelf, a brass knob on the front door, a wood plank on the outdoor deck. Those are all things that could be dangerous to you or to me. And so we'll find out why as we visit with him and what we should be doing about it with Dr. Blanc. And certainly if you want to join in with your own questions or comments or experiences, you're most welcome at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Dr. Paul Blanc joins us by phone. Dr. Blanc, thank you for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're most welcome.
You know, people might wonder how a brass knob on the front door could create a problem.
Well, that's in order to remind people to think about a kind of illness that people get from certain exposures that presents just like having a bad flu. And it's one of the names of that is called metal fume fever. Now, you're not going to get that from touching a brass doorknob, but the same thing that's in brass, which is in zinc oxide, people are exposed to a lot when they do welding. In Wisconsin, there are a lot of people who weld
around
the house and in particularly in the agricultural home industry.
How did you come to put this book together?
Well, I'm a specialist in occupational medicine, which is diseases that people get from their work. A lot of people think that that's a new specialty, but in fact, it's been around for several hundred years, unfortunately.
And you write about that early on in your book, that when you explain what you do, people sometimes say, is that new?
Yeah, that's right. That's like sports medicine, they think, or something.
Well, tell us how your book is organized.
Well, what I try to do is, rather than emphasize biographies of famous people, is to really talk about the life cycle of products. It takes them through from the first time they were introduced until they become obsolescent or are banned, and then something else is introduced, which sometimes is equally as much a problem. I mean, that's really been the story with glues, for example.
Yeah, and glues have created lots of problems for especially our younger set, I guess.
Well, in various different ways. You know, glues started off being a pretty benign thing because they were basically just cooked animal parts for a couple of thousand years. But once people figured out how they could use chemical solvents to dissolve rubber, and rubber cement was introduced, a whole series of problems started to emerge. And there still are rubber cements with some problem-ridden solvents out there, and that's been a problem. I think you were talking about youth. That's been a problem in terms of drug abuse with glue sniffing.
Yeah, It's an unfortunate problem that we haven't. I don't know that it's growing. Hopefully, it's getting less or falling out of vogue among younger people. But it's certainly nothing to fool with. That's for sure.
And then these glues have been, to a large extent, replaced by all of these two-part glues that people use: super glues, epoxies, various polymers that people mix in their own homes.
What, you know, in some parts of Wisconsin, including Madison, there have been some warnings on about manganese in the water. In fact, it's been found in higher doses in some wells in the city of Madison, one of the areas. What about this kind of issue?
Well, manganese is really a threat not from our water system, but potentially from the air. And the reason is because although we have managed to phase out lead in gasoline, the same company who invented organic lead to put in gasoline in the 1920s is now pushing a manganese organic derivative to add to gasoline. So far, the EPA has been delaying that. It's been introduced in Canada, however. And, of course, the issue with that is if you disperse manganese in fine particles into the atmosphere, people can inhale it. Luckily, when you drink it in water, our body has pretty good ways of controlling manganese intake from our stomachs and our intestines. Mm. But when you inhale it, it gets into the body much more efficiently. And also there's evidence that when you inhale manganese, unlike most things that you inhale, if it's large particles and it gets trapped in your nose, that's a good thing. But manganese has a peculiarity where the nerves in the nose are able to pick it up and transport it into the brain. And the problem with manganese in the brain is it causes Parkinson's.
Oh, boy. Well, Pat in Mazamani has a question for you, so let's go to Pat. Hi, Pat. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I just recently took up watercolor, and I noticed that many of the colors in watercolor paints have cadmium in it, and they do have notice that there's cadmium in it, but I wonder if that's a negligible effect or if that's some kind of a problem with using the paints that should be avoided.
Well, you certainly wouldn't want to ingest or particularly inhale large amounts of cadmium. Cadmium is a problem for people who do home. Another problem with people who do home welding. Have you ever heard of silver solder?
Yeah.
Well, silver solder actually is not silver. It's got cadmium in it. And that's not a problem so much when people use it as solder. But if you then take an acetylene torch and cut something that has silver solder in it, you can release a lot of cadmium fume. And that's the way in which cadmium is the most important problem. You don't want to be ingesting it long-term either. But I would imagine that in trace amounts in a watercolor, it's not going to be a big problem.
Is cadmium an initiator or a promoter, or do you even talk about things like that anymore?
Well, cadmium, in terms of cancer risk, the problems with cadmium is not related to cancer. Cadmium is actually something which is associated with emphysema, and there is a cancer association with cadmium in terms of prostate cancer. I haven't seen recent data, so I don't know if that suspicion was ever confirmed, but it actually has to do much more importantly with the lungs and with the kidneys. It causes kidney disease, and in Japan there was a large outbreak of chronic kidney disease related to cadmium that had contaminated their rice supply at one point.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling. And Roman in Wausau will give you a chance. Roman, hi.
Hi, good morning. I just got your program. I'm driving, but we built a deck last spring with treated lumber, and I really don't want to paint it if I can avoid it, but I would like to do something. Is there any kind of a stain or anything that would put a barrier between the toxins there?
It really depends on what kind of treated lumber it is. You know, they've been phasing out the arsenic-treated lumber.
They call it green-treated. That's what I bought.
They've had some green things that are being substituted for the arsenical. So the first thing I do is go back to your supplier and find out what actually was the green treatment that they used.
In other words, arsenic is the one you should worry. If it's something else, it's probably not too bad.
Well, I won't be unequivocal, because with the replacements, as with so many other things, some of the long-term health studies they really haven't done. But by the same token, you use a stain, I don't know whether you'll get just as many problems from using that. So first what I would do is find out what exactly you had used. And they should be able to give you a material safety data sheet that will tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Jane in Menominee, we turn to you next. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning, Larry.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I am concerned about the new numbers coming out for autistic children. I mean, there's one in 166. And I am wondering if it's related to an environmental kind of poisoning issue out there, and something we just haven't totally identified yet. It just seems like that number, you know, is horrific. Yeah. And we're going to be paying the price for whatever that product is in the future with these children.
Well, I'm not aware so far of any convincing epidemiologic study about a specific risk factor that has been identified. And it's not my area of expertise, the epidemiology of autism, but that's as much as I'm aware of about it. I know that people have had a lot of concerns about various things which have been looked at in a lot of detail, and nothing has panned out so far.
Hmm.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Jane, for calling in. Paul in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. My question is, I heard a mental health professional talking about the fact that, you know, there are legislation for emissions from factories, et cetera, for specific chemicals. But he had mentioned that there aren't very good legislation as far as the chemicals being combined together. And I was wondering what your guest could say about that.
Well, first of all, I'm not even so convinced that there are such great legislative enforcement related to some of the specific exposures. We do have sort of a short list of criteria air pollutants for which there are standards. As you know, there's been a big fight about standards for particulates, which is a very just basic kind of dust, small particle exposure, and even that there's been recent fights about. The one thing that some of the rules are designed to deal with in terms of combinations are the rules related to photochemical smog, because that really is related to a combination of things in the atmosphere and how they act together. So beyond that, that's not only true for air pollutants, but for exposures that people have on the job, there are really not great standards that take into account the combination of multiple exposures.
Interesting. Paul, thank you. I appreciate the call very much. Our guest today, Dr. Paul Blanc, a professor of medicine and holds the endowed chair in occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California in San Francisco, and is the author of How Everyday Products Make People Sick, Toxins at Home and in the Workplace. And you can join in our conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. We're going to take a look at the news, and then he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. So stay with us. Talking with Dr. Paul Blanc today, author of How Everyday Products Make People Sick, Toxins at Home and in the Workplace, published by the University of California Press. Glad to have you listening in. Certainly lots of people online to ask questions. And Dr. Blanc, I wanted to go back just to your chapter, the second chapter of your book, where you talk about the shadow of smoke, how to evade regulation. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things I compare it to is the Kubler-Ross stages of death and dying, where the first response of the industrial sector, the people who are at liability, is to deny altogether that there's a problem. And then there's a sort of process of slow acceptance, but brought about with a lot of bargaining and trying to really evade the ultimate necessity for controls. In general, the preferable means of control is always substitution of less hazardous products. But you can understand that if someone is manufacturing something, often they don't want to substitute a material.
Yeah, it's interesting. Daniel in Rice Lake, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Daniel. Thank you for calling.
I learned blacksmithing and silversmithing. What are the dangers of exposure to the fumes of iron oxide and silver oxide?
Well, actually, not terrible. There is a kind of a chest X-ray picture that people get with very high amounts of iron oxide fume. And typically in a smithing operation, you wouldn't be working at temperatures high enough to actually generate iron oxide fume. Iron oxide fume is more a problem in people who are truly in a smelter situation. And similarly, silver is only a problem with very high chronic ingestion. There have been people who have made themselves sick with silver who have been ingesting silver as an alternative antibiotic. And a lot of people who got quite obsessed with the millennium change in 2000, this tended to be a problem among certain alternative health practice users. The problem more in smithing that people get into trouble with historically has actually been the fumes of the fuel that they use to make the fires.
Oh.
And so if things aren't well vented, people have had problems with certainly with carbon monoxide poisoning in particular. And if you think of the old-fashioned smithy who is working in winter in a cold climate and closes the ventilation off a bit, this is a particular problem.
Hmm.
And some other physical problems, believe it or not, the long exposure to the kinds of flames can sometimes cause problems with cataracts if the infrared exposure is high enough.
Interesting. Thanks, Daniel, for calling. Tim and Ladysmith, it's your turn next. Hi, Tim.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call. Two questions. What you know about aspartame, and the other question would be, are toxins released in plastic when you microwave it?
Let me take the second question first. I think it would depend quite a bit on what the plastic is. There are ways of releasing toxins from plastic even without microwaving it. So sometimes storing things in plastic bags, which are not meant for storage, particularly plastic bags which may have a lot of coloration in them that have been used for something else, can be sometimes a problem. Another problem with microwaves or with routine stoves has been with Teflon-coated polymers, because if you overheat Teflon, you can release quite irritating gases. So there are so many different kinds of plastics. The in general, those are some of the issues involved. And in terms of your first question, I don't have any expertise in aspartame, or actually the other artificial food sweeteners in general. Is not an area that I could comment on.
Okay, thanks, Tim, for calling. Stacy in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. I was reading on the back of a natural laundry detergent how it said the standard detergents contain UV brighteners and phosphates, and they permanently bind to the skin cells. And I'm wondering if you're aware of any health problems from that.
I don't know the particular product you're talking about. I can tell you that there's been some interesting problems over time with some of the various laundry products, detergents. And the most famous was a problem that they had more in Europe than they had here when they introduced a series of enzymes into laundry detergent. And the people who worked in the factories making the enzyme detergents started to develop bad asthma because they became sensitized and allergic to the enzymes that were added to the product. And eventually this spilled over into the people using the detergents at home, so that some of the people who didn't work in the factories but simply used the material in the house developed the same problem. And that's an important point, which is that people presume that there's this magic dividing line between consumers and people who work in manufacturing or work or are otherwise exposed occupationally, and that's not the case. People who work with products in general have higher exposure, so they tend to manifest the problems first. But if we had better controls to protect workers, we would actually be protecting consumers as well.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. As long as we're on that sort of topic, someone else, and I mentioned bleach in the beginning of the show, someone else called in and said, well, what about household bleach as a problem?
Well, bleach is a problem that results in actually many thousands of calls to poison control centers around the country every year. Now, some of that is because people inadvertently ingest bleach, but an important problem is when people mix bleach with other products, particularly with acids. You may think that that's a kind of obscure possibility, but in fact, if you look around at what the other products we have for cleaning in the house are, a lot of them are acids, either hydrochloric acid or phosphoric acid. Almost all of those tile cleaning products that people buy are acids. And when you mix them, you release chlorine gas. You make a little chlorine gas bomb in the home. And people sometimes do it intentionally, but often people do it because they use one product, they don't get the effect they want, so they use a second, and they're sequentially mixing without realizing it.
Robert and Nina, your turn now. Hi, Robert.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about some on-the-job exposure that I had to some chemicals. I had been doing industrial spray painting for 11 years, and the main cleaner that we had was toluene, and it's also in the paint, and then plus we also used a lot of two-part epoxy paints, mixtures. Last December, I had a seizure while in the paint booth and went down, had a seizure at work, two more on the way into the hospital in the ambulance, another one when I got to the hospital, and I didn't wake up for 3 days. I had MRIs, CAT scans. They said there was some brain swelling. I'm still, to this day, this happened in 2005. I'm still on anti-seizure medications. I haven't had another seizure since, but I was wondering what the possibility. I know California considers toluene a carcinogen, and I know it can cause genetic and neurological problems.
Well, I'm going to say two things. One is I don't want to go into great detail in any way that would be a direct consultation on your case. But what I will say is that solvents as a group have effects on the central nervous system that can be like alcohol. And alcohol, of course, can also be associated with seizures. So it is not impossible for a heavy solvent exposure to cause problems. What I would say is that if you have not seen an occupational health specialist to date, you definitely should have this event and the history evaluated very carefully by an occupational health specialist. And I am pretty sure that at the University of Wisconsin Medical Center, they have such specialists, and there are also such specialists in Chicago. And secondly, that if this was not reported through the workers' compensation system in Wisconsin, it should be.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Robert. And I had another question relating to that, but it's just skipped my mind here temporarily. So we'll go on to Stephen and Lafarge and see if I can bring that back up.
For the previous caller, the toluene is so toxic to the nervous system. He spent almost a dozen years in a paint booth. Well, he'll reap the rewards for that because his nervous system is shot. Sorry. I'd like to ask the guest, when you step back and you look at this gigantic experiment that humanity is engaged in with all of these toxins, we're just the frog slowly getting boiled, and it's all so pervasive and ubiquitous. But it's a great way to wipe out the human species. For that, I'm grateful. Thanks a lot for the show.
All right. Dr. Blanc, you want to make a comment?
Well, I'm not in favor of wiping out the human species if I'm being asked to take a stand on that.
No. thank you, Stephen. Joanne and Heartland, your turn. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
About a year and a half, I think it was, I started noticing that I had almost hay fever-like symptoms, and sometimes, I don't want to say asthma, but it would affect also my bronchial tubes a little bit. And then within the last 6 months, it's really gotten much more severe. And I've put it together with my newspaper and newspaper print. And it really started being bad with all the colored dyes that were being, dyes in the newspapers. It's so bad now that if when I open up the Sunday paper, for example, and bring it in and spread it out, it's almost instantaneous. I have a runny eyes, runny nose. If it's really severe, it gets down my throat also. It kind of concerns me because with all the colored print I teach school that there is out there in books, et cetera, is that getting to be a problem and we're not seeing it as a problem?
Well, of course, certainly people do get sensitized to various dyes that are used for textiles, and the possibility, you know, people do develop allergies in the printing industry as well. What is also important in what you're reminding people is that symptoms of nasal allergies, or what people call hay fever, often are connected to and sometimes can be the first manifestation of asthma or combined with asthma. And this can occur in relationship to specific sensitization, and certainly can happen to adults who've had no previous history of disease. In the situation that you're describing, because the possibility for encountering specific allergens can happen both on the job and off the job, I think it would be very important for you to see an allergist and try to have some specific testing to see if you can identify if there is something you've become specifically sensitized to.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling, Joanne. And Marilyn in Milwaukee, we turn to you next. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
For about 11 and a quarter years, I had been working with a product called E6000. And on the label, it's got its side effects and cancerous effects. But I'm wondering what effect it has possibly, okay, on the skin, how it manifests other areas, aggravating the body.
Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not. Of course, there are hundreds of thousands of products. But let me just give some advice on some of the generic things that one can do aside from looking at what's on a label and trying to sort things out. And one thing is that everybody has the right to get something called a material safety data sheet for products with which you work, and often products which you purchase even through a commercial supplier. So I would try to get the material safety data sheet to the product in question, and then if you're having any symptoms that you suspect are related to the product, to start with your general primary care provider, bringing in the material safety data sheet and go from there and see if a lot of times you do need additional consultation, but that's a good place to start. The second thing I'd say is that you're not the first caller to bring up an issue about cancer risk from products. I think that it's interesting how much people focus on the issue of long-term cancer risks from materials, but sometimes they do that, neglecting many of the other non-cancer-related health hazards. It's important to remember that there are a variety of different ways in which things can impact the health, not just because of distant cancer risk.
What about how do people get that data sheet, those data sheets?
The manufacturer is obliged to provide them, or your employer is obliged to provide them.
Okay.
Right. We did have access to that. But I'm just wondering as far as affecting skin, as far as deterioration of the system, to maybe affecting other areas.
I can't comment on that directly. I'm sorry. I wish I could, but I can't.
And will that data sheet provide that kind of information?
It will. In general, there should be a section on the material safety data sheet where it does talk about dermatitis or skin irritation, and would also should also, if it's a good material safety data sheet, give information on how easily a particular material is absorbed through the skin.
Okay, and the official title of it is Material Safety Data Sheet.
That's right, or MSDS.
MSDS is the acronym for that.
Yeah.
Good luck, Marilyn. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Ken in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Ken.
Hello. There are several things about which I've been wondering for a long time. Number one, I used to work in an environment in which graphite parts were machined, and therefore you had a lot of graphite small particles and dust in the air. I was wondering, you know, the potential adverse health effects from that, breathing that in.
That's an interesting and somewhat complicated question. Graphite in general, like carbon black, has been difficult to show that there are as heavy a health burden as you might suspect, because it looks kind of nasty. And I am not completely up to date on the graphite literature. What I will say is that if you do look at people who work in very dusty trades, it is important at least to have some kind of screening, chest X-ray and lung function test, just to see where you are now at least. And I'm not aware of it being a lung cancer issue.
Fine. The second question, the bottled water that we buy in supermarkets, be it distilled or spring water, is stored in plastic bottles. Are there any adverse health effects from storing them in bottles like that, plastic bottles?
Not that I'm aware of. As you may remember, there was a question about contamination of the water itself in one of the brands with low levels of benzene, and I don't think that that came from the bottling.
It came from something else, okay.
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Ken. Dr. Blank, you do a lot of consulting, do you not, in this area with companies and businesses?
Not so much with companies. I see clinical cases as they come in, and I do research looking from an epidemiologic perspective at groups of people.
And what's the nature of your research? Talk a little more about that.
I focus mostly on lung disease because in occupational exposures, one of the key problems is things that people inhale. So I've done a lot of work related to asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in relation to work. But I've also done work related to other toxic effects. I'm a consulting physician for our regional poison control center, so end up consulting from that point of view as well.
And one of the things you mentioned, I believe, in the book had to do with artificial nails.
Artificial nails have been a problem, and again, it's a good example of the connection between the workplace and the community, because people obviously who put on these artificial nails all the time for a living have the highest exposures. These nails, in terms of putting them on, is some of the same exposures that are involved with some of these modern glues, because these are polymers that are reacting as they're being put on, and therefore are capable of causing various allergies, both to the skin and the lungs. The other problem has been when people have removed artificial nails, there have been some fairly potent chemicals that people have used in the home to remove artificial nails. This is not the same thing as nail polish remover, by the way. These have tended to be a bit more potent and have gone through several generations of products, because some of the products that they marketed initially were so toxic that they were removed altogether from the market. In fact, there were children who died from drinking the material.
Oh, my gosh. Brian and Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Brian.
How you doing today?
Good.
Just got a quick comment and a question. MSDS sheets are really difficult to read. It would be nice if there was a standardized form that every company used. My question specifically was regarding iodine as a sanitizer. If there are any prolonged contact health detrimental issues.
Well, there are people, by the way, who get sensitized to it just through skin contact. But in general, iodine is not well absorbed, luckily, through whole skin. The problems have happened when iodine has been used on areas where the skin is not normal. So people have chronic dermatitis, or have had skin burns, and sick patients in the hospital with the skin which is not intact, and large areas of iodine have been used. But in general, absent someone developing an actual sensitivity and a rash from using it, you should not be absorbing very much of it from normal skin.
Okay. How about in regards to inhalation? As we use iodine in a food processing environment where it's sort of spun clean in place as a process, so you get a little bit of, I don't think it's necessarily aerosol, but there certainly is some mist.
Well, that is an aerosol, and that could be a problem, because, again, with so many things, it may not be absorbed through the skin, but once you inhale it, you can be absorbing it. And there are a couple different ways to approach that, but one is the engineering discipline that comes and measures exposures is called industrial hygiene. So one way to measure that is to is actually to have someone come to the plant and measure what the airborne concentrations of iodine are. But short of that, for the individual, one lucky thing about iodine is it's very easy to measure in the body.
Hmm.
And so measuring either iodine concentration in the urine or in the blood, even though it's a specialty test, would be an easy way to look at that. The issue with iodine, one issue with iodine is it's so closely tied to thyroid function that ingesting iodine can impact that.
Well, Dr. Blanc, I appreciate you being with us today. I thank you very much and look forward to, I haven't finished your book, so look forward to that. And thanks again for being with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Dr. Paul Blanc, author of How Products Make People Sick. And thank you for listening.